just time to take a seat so we can kind of get this next session started here. This morning, we're going to begin with Dr. Dave Lahman from Oklahoma State University. All right, guys, calm down here in the front row. I need a little attention, please. We're going to start with Dr. Dave Lahman from Oklahoma State University. Dave is a Kansas native from that Fort Scott area, graduated from K-State. Yes. Went to Montana State for a master's and finished with a PhD in nutrition at the University of Missouri. And Dave and I are going to tag team on this thing, but Dave's going to begin by talking about nutrition and reproduction in beef cows. And I know that many of us in here, you know, hear about this stuff all the time. But the truth of it is there's new stuff coming along that ought to interest us, and ought to interest us from a cow-calf side in terms of lowering our cost of production and yet getting the same type of production, same type of results. So, Dave, I'll let you take it away.
Thank you, Dr. Stucka. I really enjoyed that last session. I hope most of you are able to participate, and maybe some of the discussion we get into here this next hour and a half or so will dovetail into that nicely. In fact, I thought, where's Dr. Stroh being? Stroh, Dr. Stuck and I, of course, reminded everybody he's just a veterinarian, but our take on that first scenario in terms of ranking the highest priorities of what that operation needs to work on is I think they need to buy a knife and castrate their bull calves. So we think maybe quality assurance is an important issue in that scenario. The big picture, let me just tell you kind of what we're going to talk about for the first 5 or 10 minutes, and then I want to get into more specifics. But this is a broad subject, the influence of reproduction on, or influence of nutrition on reproduction. And so I had to make some hard choices in terms of what to spend our time on today. And so I chose to spend most of my time on a topic that, as Dr. Stucka mentioned, is a little bit more in the forefront. More data is coming available. There's a lot of interest in this particular subject in the beef industry. But let me just take a minute and review quickly for you the big picture, one of the big items relative to nutrition's influence on reproduction. And you all are very well educated on this topic. I'm aware of that, and so that's why I chose not to spend much time on it. But we need this foundation in order to continue the discussion in more detail. Genetics in yesterday's environment determines today's body condition. We could talk a lot about cow efficiency and environmental influences on energy stores and beef cows. Of course, you know, drought situations, wet, cold winters, forage availability, all of those types of things, of course, are part of that picture. And then adaptation and body condition, and perhaps adaptation includes genetics, or their ability to adapt is dependent upon genetics to some extent. But body condition certainly is a big factor that influences tomorrow's reproductive success. And I'm going to show you here in just a minute that it is fairly clear in the literature that the most important time to evaluate energy stores in beef cows, or the most important, critical timing is that body condition and those energy stores at the time of calving. Okay, let me just give you a quick summary, some data that points this out. And this is a large data set with a lot of different experiments included, and averages the pregnancy rate of several different beef herds over three different condition score groups. Of course, body condition score scale 1 to 9, with the 5 being a moderate cow, 1 being extremely emaciated, and 9 being extremely obese. Body condition score group, when these cows are grouped less than 4, average pregnancy rate was 60, and then body condition score 6 or greater. Of all these experiments, the average pregnancy rate was 92%. And remember, that was a body condition on the day they calved, or right around that time. The really interesting thing, though, I think about this data set is the variability in terms of pregnancy rate among these different studies. And here you see that white line represents all of the studies that were pooled, the lowest pregnancy rate for this group, and the highest pregnancy rate. So extreme variation. And perhaps this is where some of that adaptation and genetics comes into play. But as you increase on the condition score at calving, that variance declines incredibly. Okay, so this may be a more important story than the actual pregnancy rate or the actual average of all those experiments. Because there are certainly a lot of you in the room here, particularly those from the western part of the United States, that would just think you had a big problem if your cows were able to calve in a body condition score 5. You'd think they were extremely fat. Those cows are adapted to get along in a harsh environment, calve year in and year out, body condition score 4, and breed back at 90% plus. So certainly that would be more the case in the western part of this country than back east. Okay, so just another data set that makes this point. This is some of the work I did when I was at the University of Missouri. And here you have number of days from calving to first heat is the data that you see in the table. So these white letters or white numbers are number of days, what we consider a postpartum interval. Then you've got condition score at calving. These are two-year-old heifers. Some are extremely thin. And then the fleshiest heifers we had in this experiment were only a 5.5. And so they all lean toward the thin side of the scale. Then we place those cattle on different energy concentration or diet caloric densities from tree bark to ice cream so that these cows would continue to lose weight, maintain their weight and body condition, or have dramatic increases in their weight and body condition by 90 days after calving. Okay, so let's just take a look here. For example, a two-year-old heifer that calved in a body condition score of 4, she was able to maintain her body condition based on her genetics, milk production, and the diet that she received. Still took her 131 days to cycle. That's not good. Older cows, you'd expect that number to be considerably lower on the average. I think Dr. Spitzer, right up here in the front row, has documented that heifers frequently have, about a 21-day on average, something like that, 20 to maybe 25-day, 14 to 21-day longer postpartum interval and more mature animals. Okay, so then let's take another animal, a condition score 5 heifer, that also maintained her body weight, and just look at that difference in days to first heat. And that difference in this, making those two comparisons, is 28 days. All right, then let's look at a different combination then. Let's say we started in a 4, and our plan is going to be to make up ground after she calves. I'll tell you right now, that's not a good plan, and I know you're well aware of that for a number of reasons. But here's one of the reasons. We're going to try to make her gain a full body condition score so that she's equal to this cow right here by 90 days after calving. Well, her postpartum interval is still 115 days. Okay, and so if you compare the difference between those two numbers, it's 16. Yeah, we made some improvement, but we only backed it up 16 days. So you compare 28 to 16, I just use that as an example to make the point that as Dr. Spitzer and probably several other, Ivan Rush and others in the room, Rick Rasby, have documented time and time again that the most important time to evaluate or aim for optimal body condition in terms of as a reflection of the nutritional program is that time at calving. One more data set. This is some of Dr. Wedeman's work at Oklahoma State. Here he's got one set of heifers that were calved greater than a body condition score 5 and they were fed to gain weight afterwards. That's this green line right here. This is weight change over time. Then he had a set of heifers that were managed to calve in a body condition score greater than 5 and just hold their own. That's this line right here. Okay, and then he had heifers that were calved thin and fed to gain weight, just like just like the fleshier heifers and heifers that were calved in a thinner condition. And his original intention was that they just maintain their body weight and they wound up gaining it. Let me just show you the pregnancy rates on these four groups. 36%, as you might anticipate, in the thin heifers that maintain their body weight. 66% if they calve thin and were allowed to gain weight through the nutritional program. Believe me, it took a lot of feed to get that done. 91% if they calved in a moderate body condition and just maintained afterwards, and then 94% if they had the best of both worlds. Okay, so that's kind of the big picture. And I think the moral of the story then, when you're talking about the grand scheme of the influence of nutrition on reproduction, is achieving moderate body condition at calving is more effective than trying to make up ground or energy stores after calving. Playing catch-up is almost always expensive and usually not practical. It frequently takes nearly a feedlot-type ration or extremely high-quality forage for cows to be able to do that. And if you're fortunate, you're calving in a time of the year when you can utilize your forage program to do that. You don't have to rely upon harvested feed. So in that case, maybe you might be able to make it work at least a little bit more practically. What we found is that when you feed, when you purchased and pack out through the cow some purchased or harvested feed source, feed grains and so on, you increase the supplementation level, nearly 70% of that increased energy is partitioned to milk production alone. Ask any dairy producer. If they back off on the concentrate portion of a dairy cow's diet by 2 to 4 pounds, tomorrow their milk production goes down dramatically. Okay, it's the same in the beef cow, just not as extreme. Most of the supplemental energy goes to milk production. Okay, and some of the stuff we did at the University of Missouri shows that you have to get up to a concentrate diet, nearly a feedlot ration, before you begin the metabolic processes and endocrine system start sending the signal to the cow, direct some of these energy stores to the cow and not so much to milk production. But at marginal energy supplementation, it 70% plus goes to milk production. Okay, and so then you kind of have to start working through your scenario and your production system and saying, well, can I really afford that? And I would submit to you that most of the time the answer is no. Okay, energy stores then can be obviously influenced by these many factors, grazing conditions, which I guess in Missouri and western part of the United States has experienced severe conditions and limitations this past year and currently. Early weaning, obviously, is one tool that you have in your toolbox to improve upon condition at calving the following year. Limit feeding concentrates. I don't know if we'll have time to get to this today or not. I brought a few slides, but I think particularly since the cost of corn primarily and other energy-type commodities has declined through the fall, and it's currently fairly reasonable again. And for those of you who have very limited forage availability and you don't want to have to sell all your cows, it's probably one of the least cost maintenance energy sources for a beef cow. You can make it work with corn in a cow. It's a little bit out in left field, but it can work. We've got a lot of folks doing it in Oklahoma and several families we work with in Montana, and some of the people I still talk to in Missouri using this kind of a program now. Protein or energy supplementation during fall and winter prior to calving, that's our traditional method to fix energy store problems. Okay, in Oklahoma, the big argument is, should we feed 20s or 40s? Okay, that's 20% cubes or 40% cubes. The idea is that if we think we need to supply, let's say, 8/10 a pound of crude protein, supplemental crude protein, we're going to feed 2 pounds of 40% cubes. Okay, 2 pounds times 0.4 is 8/10. That's the smallest package. On a cost per day basis, it's the lowest cost. The question, though, we often get into is, would I be better off feeding 4 pounds of 20% cubes, still delivering 8 tenths pound of protein, but doubling the supplemental energy intake? And what do you think is the best seller in the feed industry? What would you guess?
40% cubes.
We'd like for it to be 40% cubes. Actually, our feed companies in the state of Oklahoma sell 3 times as much 20% cubes. And I submit to our people all over the state all the time, and I'm sure they're tired of me saying this, but if you have optimal forage conditions, you've got a lot of good standing stockpiled forage that's low quality, at least it is in Oklahoma, there's not much sense in feeding higher energy. And you get by with a small package, it's the lowest cost per day, because those cows, in fact, some of our cows will increase body condition through the winter on good quality tall grass prairie, stockpiled tall grass prairie. Now, I know that doesn't represent the situation that many of you would have. So a lot of research has gone into asking that question, are we better off with increased energy supplementation to improve the reproduction of our beef cows and our overall costs? There are probably in the, well, beyond 50 publications and maybe close to 100 publications that have investigated protein supplementation before and after calving and energy supplementation before and after calving. Okay, when I say supplementation, I'm talking about feeding some sort of a protein energy supplementation somewhere between 2 and, say, up to 7 or 8 pounds per day. And particularly in our fall calving herds, it's not uncommon, at least in Oklahoma, for some people to try to maintain body condition in a fall calving cow using 7 or 8 pounds of a supplement. Remember what I told you, most of that is going to hold up, kind of jack up, hold up milk production. Okay, and they think they're trying to hold their cow's body condition together. I wish I had time to share with you our fall calving research program. I don't have. But what we've found is that if you provide adequate protein, use a small package, the lowest cost per day, what you do is you determine the cow's nutrient requirement. You make that decision. We think we often have to feed a cow to meet her requirements when what we're really doing is determining her requirements by the amount of energy we feed. If we feed a cow 7 or 8 pounds of, let's say, 20% cubes to a fall calving cow, we'll get up to anywhere from, say, 15 to 22 pounds of milk production within the first 90 days of calving. If we pull the rug out from under and feed 2 or 3 pounds of the 40% cubes, guess what happens to our milk production? It goes down to 10 to, say, 14 pounds. We've really lowered our maintenance cost on that cow. Now, what do you think the calves look like in March and April? Little hairballs, right? We treat them pretty good until we pull the bull out in January, but then we pull the rug out from under them, so to speak, after we're fairly confident that they're pregnant. And then from April to weaning in early July, they gain 3 pounds a day. And those calves are coming off the cows weighing 650 to 700 pounds, the steers would. So we like that program. We're determining the cow's maintenance requirements by the way we feed them, not the other way around. That's a little bit backwards of how we like to look at it. And then the forage program, we can't hardly keep those fall calving cows from getting... I told you I wasn't going to talk about this, and I'm getting off into it, aren't I? But we can't keep them from getting fat because they have adequate, high-quality forage all summer long, and they get fat and they have a good body condition anyway. Well, that takes care of the big picture. And so they breed back really well, 93 to 95% pregnancy rate in that particular research program. Okay, so with that said and that foundation laid, let's talk about, I thought there was a lot of interest, it appears to me, in terms of energy supplementation, particularly regarding fat supplementation, the effects of fat supplementation on reproduction. So I chose to spend some time on that. your hands-on part of this session is going to help be to help me conduct a literature review. Okay, we're going to do a two-slide literature review and kind of give you a view of where we're at on that question. You see it in the press just everywhere you look. Nearly every land-grant institution represented in this room is doing one or more experiments right now on this question. We're looking into it at Oklahoma State with several experiments. But the idea, there's two concepts. One is, can you use fat supplementation to a beef animal, particularly a spring calving animal that's receiving average to low quality forage in the wintertime? Okay, this question has been explored for a long time in the cattle feeding business. Concentrate rations. We're just really beginning to look into it relative to a forage fed animal. Okay, well, I said there was 50 to 100 publications on protein and energy supplementation. And energy, I'm talking about concentrates like corn, wheat middlings, things like that. But there's only, I'm going to show you 16 experiments have been published so far, and many of these are still in state research reports, haven't made it to the peer-reviewed process yet. And so we're still very early on regarding this question. Now, fat supplementation can do two things for you. One idea is that it's simply to increase caloric density and performance of the cows for the winter. Just like feeding another couple, 2, 3, 4 pounds of corn. Same idea. The other idea or possibility is that fat supplementation may be a magic bullet. Is there a possibility that fat supplementation could be a reproductive nutraceutical? Could it have some sort of a biological impact relative to reproduction independent of its caloric contribution to that cow's supplementation program? Okay, we use protein primarily just to optimize forage utilization of rumen function. That gets us increased overall energy intake and increased microbial protein supply. Probably 80% of a cow's protein supply is met through this system right here by the microbial protein. Okay, so we encourage our producers to first in their supplementation program, if they want to optimize reproduction, keep the cost low, first make sure you're doing a good job with protein supplementation. And then we move on to vitamins, minerals, energy. Okay, some of particular oilseed meals do supply some undegradable intake protein, which meets animals' metabolizable protein requirement beyond microbial protein. But those are the two reasons that we supplement protein. Energy, we're interested in either increasing body condition. Some cases, we're interested in replacing forage when it's limited or you have to purchase expensive hay. And then the final objective would be to use it as a reproductive nutraceutical. Okay, this is just an example of how it might work as a reproductive nutraceutical. This is an experiment that we conducted a couple of years ago with mature cows. Green bar here is pregnancy rate in cows that were supplemented with raw whole soybeans. Here you've got rolled soybeans. In this column, we have a positive control that's a traditional range cube providing equal protein and energy to these two treatments. Here you have a negative control that has equal protein, just lower energy. Okay, so what I want to show you is, I'm not going to show you the performance data on the cows, but these cows actually lost more weight and condition, only slightly, but they did lose more weight and condition compared to the more traditionally supplemented cows using traditional sources. They actually lost a little bit more weight and condition. Yet, they bred back better. Now, that difference is not statistically significant, but it's certainly in the positive direction. So that's what I mean when I say reproductive nutraceutical. Is there something going on besides just cow weight and body condition change? Okay. How many pounds? In that experiment, it's raw whole soybeans is 2 pounds. 2 pounds. And that's a little bit under what we normally would feed, but in an experiment, we were looking at the protein quality of the whole soybeans without being processed. And so whenever we're looking into that question, we always underfeed them slightly so you can separate the differences better. Yes, yes, ma'am. Push the podium back. Stroke. Can we do that? Yeah, it looks like it'll go back pretty easy. I'll let my bodyguards take care of that. Well, that's a good question. She said, did we select soybeans in that experiment because it has natural or a similar estrogenic type activity? And no, that we did not do that for that purpose. The reason we did select them is because they're available to us. Oklahoma keeps trying to be an Oklahoma producing or soybean producing state. You know, we're only marginally successful because we'll have all that red dirt and little rainfall, but it's readily available, and in fact, in that experiment, we used drought-damaged soybeans and found out that, gosh, when you can only sell drought-damaged soybeans for $2.50 a bushel, their feeding value is $7 to $8 per bushel. So that was the reason we did it. But that's a good question, and you have to wonder, would the estrogenic activity have something to do with this nutraceutical impact? And I don't know the answer to that. It's a really good question, comment. Okay. Yes, yes, sir.
Since you said that you use drought-stressed soybeans, did that affect the protein quality? Did that bring it down from like 4 to 6 to 20%, or how did that affect it at all?
Okay, that's another good question. And his question is, since we use drought-stressed soybeans, and these were little bitty hard BBs and green, really green, would it impact protein quality? Yes, I think it two ways. One is we found that the average protein concentration is reduced, probably in the neighborhood of by 3 to 5 percentage points compared to high-quality beans. We've not made a comparison of good quality to drought-stressed or frost-damaged beans yet. That needs to be done. But we get along great with these drought-stressed beans, so we're excited about that. Yeah, actually, palatability of those whole soybeans is pretty good. Don't they like them? Well, that's interesting. They maybe not go to them as quickly as they would a typical range supplement, but if our cows don't eat what we offer, they don't eat. So maybe that's why they ate them. That limited research data, when you look into this fat supplementation question, I've already talked about that. We're really just kind of on the verge of looking into this. There is a lot of work being done, but there are a lot of things to consider. Even these 16 or 17 experiments I'm going to show you, boy, there's just a lot of questions, a lot of factors that need to be considered, so there's quite a bit of confusion relative to this issue, and I hope maybe we can at least give you a good look at the big picture and send you home with a take-home message or two. Okay, so is fat effective beyond increasing caloric density? You have to consider the timing. Should we feed a fat source prior to calving? Or would we be better off trying to improve, say, first service conception rate if we waited until 30 days before we started to AI those cows? That's a good question. It's one we need more answers to. Fat source, oilseed mills, animal tallow, which would be higher in, they'd be higher in some of the less, what's the word I'm trying to think of, saturated, they would be higher in saturated fats compared to oilseed mills, which are higher in polyunsaturated fats. Amount to supplement, that's a question you always have to get to in the supplementation program. Would we be more likely to see a response in two-year-old cows versus mature cows? What about virgin heifers? Cow condition, would you anticipate fat to give you a reproductive response if they're in condition score 6 when they calve? Or are you going to have a situation where a cow is in a 4 before you could expect a significant response? Historical reproductive rates. We look into a lot of silver bullets, and if you start out with a reproductive history of 92% plus or even 90% plus, it's really going to be hard to improve on that with some sort of a supplementation program. Sure, you might get 1 or 2%, but you really have to question the cost effectiveness of that practice if you're only going to be able to improve 1% or 2%. Okay, so let's take a quick look at the literature. We don't have enough time to look into all the reproductive parameters, so I just chose pregnancy rate because it's something everybody understands and it's important. Very economically important trait. Okay, so the way these are set up is that I've got the author over here, and that's just for my help so I can remember where this was conducted and how it was conducted. Cow age and the number of cows per treatment. If you're looking at something published in say, media, you really need to consider number of animals. And so I tried to pick on experiments where I thought where there was at least 20 animals per treatment. I think Dr. Spitzer would probably tell you that, gosh, you got to have fairly big numbers. What's your favorite number if you're looking at, say, pregnancy rate? Dr.
Spitzer?
Something that will give him a statistical difference. And we feel like if you're looking for a difference of 10%, you got to have 50 cows per treatment. Okay, so 10 cows per treatment ain't going to cut it if you're interested in this kind of a question. So that's why that's an important item, and that's included. Supplement timing before or after calving, amount fed, and this is expressed in pounds, fat source, as you'll see, and then in this right-hand column, I've got treated versus control pregnancy rate. Okay, so let's just take a look at this first experiment. This was conducted in Montana, Dr. Bellow's group. These are first calf heifers. They started supplementing this fat source 53 days up through the calving period. They used 7/10 pound, in this case, of safflower seed. And as you can see, the control group only had a 57% pregnancy rate. So the traditional management practice or whatever conditions set that up were evidently fairly extreme. Not a very exciting pregnancy rate in that group. So, and they got a dramatic improvement in pregnancy rate in this case. Another one of Dr. Bellow's experiments. Same timing, 65 days up through calving. Half a pound of safflower soybeans. This is whole raw soybeans or whole sunflower seeds, and he's in this experiment he used genetically modified sunflowers that contain around 40 to 44% fat. That's a lot of fat in a little old sunflower, and that's with the seed coat, just like the salted ones that you like to chew on. So that's that may be a source. It seems like those would become more available that we could use in a real small package to deliver a lot of fat. Something to think about. 94 versus 79, that's a significant difference. Fairly impressive and very encouraging. Bellow's final experiment here, again, heifers. This time they used the same kind of sunflowers. They fed 1.1 pound fat. That's quite a bit of fat to two-year-old heifers. And this time the trend is in the wrong direction, and although that difference was not significant. Okay, this is Dr. Sandy Johnson's data from Kansas State. 67 mature cows per treatment. She's using the same time period, 7/800 of a pound of fat, sunflower seeds, no difference in pregnancy rates. Alexander, University of Wyoming, 48 cows, same time period, only using a 1/4 pound of fat from either sunflower oil or soybean oil in this case. Only a slight improvement, not significantly different. This was an experiment conducted in Mexico with extremely thin cows. They were body condition score 3 and under at calving, or 3.5 and under, minus 61 days to 44 days after calving. Mature cows, they used a commercial product that's primarily calcium soaps of fatty acids, 91 versus 84. It's in the right direction. The difference wasn't statistically significant. Okay, and then University of Missouri data. This data set has really got a lot of interest around the country where they used whole soybeans, I think, what, 3 pounds to deliver that 5,600 of a pound, 45 days prior to calving up to calving, in the right direction, but not a significant improvement in pregnancy rate. And I'll talk about their first service conception rate data here in just a minute. Okay, now let's, I guess maybe as far as the big picture goes, I like the trend here as far as improving, possibility of improving reproduction in first calf heifers. So there's a possibility there. As far as the cow data, I can't get very excited about that. Except for the Espinosa trial here, the Mexico study, most of these cows were in pretty good body condition when they calved. Okay, and most of these cows have, particularly these first two, or these two here, have pretty good reproduction to begin with. But I can't get as excited about the cow data. I think a lot of that probably has to do with the fact that they were in pretty decent body condition for the most part to begin with. These are all spring calving situations. I'm impressed that the Mexico experiment was able to achieve 84% pregnancy rate at that low of body condition. But I'd say those cows are probably adapted to those kind of conditions. Yes, sir. Amount, I'm sorry, that's a great point. Amount fed is fat only. So that's the amount of actual additional fat that they supplemented. Yeah, I should have clarified that. Okay, so let's do the same thing with experiments where they looked at fat supplementation after calving to see if they could find a nutraceutical benefit of these fat sources. Okay, here you've got a smaller experiment, mature cows. This rice bran was supplemented from calving until the cows cycled the first time after calving. 0.33 of a pound of fat, and here you've got a significant improvement in pregnancy rate. They saw an improvement, a reduction in that postpartum interval that we talked about earlier. So that looks promising. Here you've got another fairly small experiment, calving to 30 days after calving. Half a pound of fat delivered by this commercial product called Megalac, 72 versus 68. It's in the right direction, not significant. Burns. Let's see. This is another University of Wyoming experiment with 41 first calf heifers. They fed these 61 to 176 days after calving, so beyond the breeding season. They only fed a tenth of a pound of fish meal in this case to deliver the fat source, and as you see, no significant difference. In fact, the trend is in the wrong direction. Okay, Dr. Sandy Johnson's data from K-State again. She also had a group of cows that she applied those treatments to after calving in a factorial design. 7,800 pound of sunflower seeds again. No difference. No improvement. Those cows were in pretty good body condition at calving time. Here's the University of Missouri data. Whole soybeans. Calving to AI, half a pound, or just a little over, 87 versus 76. So once again, you've seen that data in the press a lot, but as far as pregnancy rate, there was no dramatic improvement in overall pregnancy rate. Beckmeyer, University of Wyoming. No, this is University of Illinois. Sorry. A very recent publication, the research report. Calving to 125 days. Not exactly sure how much fat they fed in that study using soybean oil. 83 versus 83. So large experiment. Cows in about a condition score of 5 at calving, grazing fescue, at least some fescue in those pastures. So no improvement. Here's the last one. This is using first calf heifers, 25 head, 50 to 120 days after calving, 2/10 of a pound of fish meal. Once again, no significant improvement in pregnancy rate. Okay, so real quickly, let's wrap that. Kind of try to summarize that. I just want to let you know that if you look through the literature on this topic, there's an upper limit to the amount of fat we're going to be able to supply to a beef cow before we get into depressing forage intake and digestion. So that's going to limit us on the upper side. And probably that number is somewhere around 5% of total dietary fat. Traditional diets contain around 1.5% to begin with, particularly if you're feeding some sort of a concentrate supplement, whether it be soybean meal or corn, wheat mix, whatever. So let's just assume that a cow is consuming 20 pounds of dry matter. To get that up to 5%, we're going to add another 3.5, right, to total 5. That means we're going to have to keep it under 7/10 of a pound for this group of cows. So let's just say we're talking about whole soybeans, 20% fat. That means you're going to have to stay under, what, around 3.5 pounds per head per day, or you would expect to have a fairly dramatic reduction in fiber intake, forage intake, and digestibility. And let me tell you, you don't want to do that. Okay? You'll kind of be robbing Peter to pay Paul. Minimum inclusion rate is going to, I think, is another factor that has to be considered. It looks like, according to a recent review by the Texas A&M group, is going to be 4%. If you're just adding another 1 or 2% to the diet, according to these titration trials that have been done, looks like it's probably not going to have much of an impact. So we have a fairly tight range, and in this cow that's consuming about 20 pounds, we're going to have to limit it to the bottom side about 0.5 pound a day. So I'd suggest to you that we probably need to aim for around 0.5 pound of an oilseed meal product to have any hope of improving performance or having that nutraceutical benefit that we've talked about. Fat supplementation has improved pregnancy in 3 out of 14 experiments. I was hoping that that number would be a lot higher. And if you read a lot of the press, you would think that it would be. Yes, sir.
You focused on pregnancy rates. Did you expect anything different for first service conception rates?
That's a good question. In fact, I think I've got a bullet item. If you'll bear with me, I'll get to that here in just a second. Marginal responses, as you've already figured out, probably due to adequate body energy stores in those cows. Remember, that's the big picture. That's probably going to drive the whole system, or adequate basal diet nutrient availability. Those go hand in hand. Expect greater response with thin cows, and perhaps with particularly with young cows that are calving in marginal condition, which to me, a young cow, a heifer in a condition score 5 is marginal. You might anticipate a fairly dramatic improvement in just pregnancy rate. So for those of you that would be in that kind of situation, I would seriously consider fat supplementation. Instead of 2-year-old heifers that were in a body condition score 5 or less. Okay, what about potential improvement in first service conception? I was going to go through that same exercise to find what I thought was the applicable literature that's been published on that. I found 2 trials so far, Darrell, that I had confidence in, enough animals, et cetera, et cetera. And you even have to have more animals for treatment when you're talking about really ferreting out a significant difference, meaningful difference in first service conception rate. 2 experiments. One was the Graham trial from the University of Missouri using whole soybeans. 13 to 16% improvement in first service conception rate only when they fed whole soybeans prior to calving. When they fed them after calving, that improvement in first service conception rate disappeared. Figure that out. I don't understand it. But they've done that 2 years in a row, and it occurred twice in a row. We probably need to repeat it another few times. Okay, the second experiment, Colorado State. They fed a fat source, about a fish meal, in fact, for 30 days prior to the AI period and then up through the artificial insemination period. In that experiment, they found a 12% improvement in first service conception rate. Okay? Totally different scenario. Very different timing. The theory, the biology says that probably around, prior to and around the breeding season, or AI period, is when it should be the most important if you're concerned about conception rate, because there's some thought that those fat sources, of course, fat is cholesterol is a precursor to progesterone synthesis. If you remember your animal science courses in reproduction, progesterone is the is what maintains pregnancy. Okay, it should assist. The idea is that the fat supplementation should assist in that cow's maternal recognition of pregnancy, so that she wouldn't create a corpus luteum or create actually prostaglandin. I said that wrong. It's prostaglandin that it inhibits. I told you completely wrong backwards. It inhibits prostaglandin production, which regresses CL. Therefore, the progesterone disappears. Pregnancy cannot be maintained. That's the idea. And it's been shown to work in this one experiment. We need a lot more work in that area. That's a good question. Okay, I probably better wrap it up and let Dr. Stucka straighten me out here, but I think the big picture is, you know, you have to ask how valuable is a 10 to 15% improvement in first service conception rate. My opinion, we're just on the verge of trying to figure that out. It looks positive. If you can do it with something like whole soybeans you've got in the bin anyway, and it doesn't cost any more than your traditional supplement source, why not? The one thing that has been proven, I think, is that these sources are not negative relative to reproduction. Okay, that's a good thing. And so if you have a cheap source of fat, like whole sunflower seeds, like in western Kansas, or soybeans throughout the Midwest here, it's a great opportunity. But you really have to consider the cost relative to the benefit. Now, I don't know if they put the limit feeding fact sheet in the proceedings. Did they? Okay, great. Well, I'll just have to refer you to that for those details of things to consider. If you might want to be, or if you need to replace forage or maintain some cows, I just want you to encourage you to think about that, because I think it is a dramatic opportunity. There's one group that, or ranch in south central Montana that my office partner works with a lot, because he was college buddies with this guy, and they're feeding 10 pounds of corn, about 6 pounds of barley straw, and nothing else. Well, a supplement, a protein supplement, 1 pound of a protein supplement. And he's maintaining those cows in Montana for 75 cents a day. Okay, so there's, now he has to go to a lot of work. He's got to feed those 1,200 cows every day, and about the same time every day. It took him and the cows a while to get used to it. It takes a lot more equipment and facilities and so on, but it can work. He's feeding whole shelled corn. Yes, sir. Yes? I'm sorry? Yes. Probably the state of Missouri is the experts, if you'd like. Gerald, just go ahead and whack that off there. At using ammoniated fescue, stubble, and straw, and so on. Really improves palatability as well as digestibility of low-quality forage. And it's, as far as a way to get yourself through a drought, it's a really nice opportunity. You can turn wheat straw into average quality prairie hay with the ammoniation process. It takes a lot of work, but it's really fun to go watch those guys in southwest Missouri do that. They'll ammoniate a stack of probably 150 round barrels in a matter of about 15 minutes. At least get the ammoniation tank in place, get it covered, get it sealed. It's just incredible how good they are at doing that. Now, my dad and brothers and I tried to do it. It's been all afternoon. Before we were done, we invited six regional fire departments to come help. We had a balloon. See, I just cranked open the tank, and I forgot it was 100 degrees, and we just cranked open. And this gas, it expands. We cranked open the tank. We had a really nice hot air balloon before we were finished. Had the neighborhood kind of concerned. Anyway, it's a nice... it's something you really ought to consider if straw is available to you and you have some anhydrous ammonia close by. Thank you.